Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Department of International Relations at Boston University. Speaking will be former German Defense Minister Volker Ruhe. Minister Ruhe's lecture is titled Transatlantic Relations in the 21st Century. Responding to the minister's lecture will be Boston University Associate Professor of International Relations, Thomas Berger. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Good evening, everybody. I'm particularly happy to welcome you this evening at our institute because we have as our guest speaker, former German Defense Minister, Mr. Volker Ruhe. His lecture is entitled Transatlantic Relations in the 21st Century. Volker Ruhe joined the CDU, Christian Democratic Union, in 1963 and was a member of the German Bundestag for 30 years, if I'm not mistaken, from 1975 to November of the last year. Shortly after his election to the Bundestag from his home city of Hamburg, he took over the chairmanship of the Foreign Domestic Policy Committee of his parliamentary group. He held the position of Secretary General of his party from 1989 until he assumed office as Minister of Defense under Helmut Kohl in April of 1992. This was a very important moment in the post-communist Europe. He was very active in the enlargement of NATO and is very warmly remembered for this in the former communist countries that joined NATO before they were able to join the European Union. He was also the first Minister of Defense to send German troops on peacekeeping operations outside the NATO area. When the Kohl government lost the election in 1998, Mr. Ruhe was elected deputy chairman of the CDU. He is now temporarily a freelance politician. He is working as an advisor and teaching at university, and we are very privileged to have him here in this intermediate moment, and we are very much looking forward to the speech today. Now, responding to Volker Ruhe is Thomas Berger, Associate Professor of International Relations at Boston University. Professor Berger is the author of Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in German and Japan. His articles and essays have appeared in numerous edited volumes and journals, including International Security, Review of International Studies, German Politics, and World Affairs Quarterly. Thank you very much, Mr. Ruhe.
Thank you, Professor Gross. I can say that transatlantic relations, I mean, have been important through all my professional career for me. And, I came even earlier to America in 1963, 43 years ago, working in the Berkshire Mountains and summer camps whilst I was a student. And ever since, I've been working in this field. And, of course, I also am interested to find out if those are right that say this period of the Cold War, where you had almost absolute harmony in the transatlantic relationships, saying this is will be a unique period. Nothing like that will ever happen again. Or if definitely in a completely new way we have a chance in this transatlantic relationship under completely different circumstances in the 21st century to be important for each other and the world. And to take some of the suspense out of what I'm going to say, I believe it is possible. But I also believe, in order to achieve that, you have to understand that the present problems in the transatlantic relationship, not in the first place, have to do with persons and politics. Of course, this president, George W. Bush, is probably not quite as popular as John F. Kennedy or others were in Europe. And the last German chancellor, obviously, over here may not be as popular as other German chancellors have been. But it's completely wrong, from my point of view, to believe that this is the main problem. If you believe that, you don't understand the deep structural changes that have occurred. First, from a German point of view, and here it is very obvious that we are much less important for each other than we used to be in the Cold War. And some people, when you say that, will say, oh, the united Germany is more important than the divided Germany. That's dead wrong. Not because united Germany is not important, but because when Germany was divided, the world was divided in Germany. And if West Germany and Berlin had gone the other way, this would have changed the whole world. And so I sometimes formulate a little cynical, I must say, we just had to be divided to be important. Even if we hadn't done anything, we would have been very, very important. And fortunately, we don't have this automatic importance anymore. But just to give you a few examples, I mean, what Germany could do, and that was during my political career also. In the Cold War, up to 1988, if there had been an attack of the Warsaw Pact, Germany could have fielded within 7 days, 1.3 million soldiers ready for combat. No more training, 1.3 million soldiers ready for combat. And that was obviously a very big contribution. We had 400,000 American soldiers in Germany. Now we're down to 70,000, we're going down to 40,000. In the present, what Germany has done in the last 10 years, and I've started this process to send soldiers also on new missions, you know this. But when you look at the numbers, what we can do with the German armed forces right now is deploy 8,000 soldiers in these new missions. Well, you need some 30, 40,000 if you want to deploy 8,000 at every time. But this is the difference. 1.3 million in 7 days combat ready, you know this. And in the new fields, and of course there's a much different importance, it is 8,000, 10,000. So that's one big reason why Germany is not automatically as important as it used to be. And America is not as important for us as it used to be. It had an existential importance. And now I would say it has an essential importance for us. But it was existential before, because there would not have been any free West Germany. My political career would not have happened. And no West Berlin, of course, would have been free without the credible American threat that if one soldier crosses the border from the other side, this is war. Existential importance. And at that time, we sometimes had arguments with the United States, but we were very careful not to have too many arguments. We were not free enough to have more arguments, just because when they just had to name the word Berlin, then we understood how dependent we were. So the first analysis is, it is just true that we are less important for each other in these days, and nobody has to complain about this, because it was the price, I mean, of the division of the world in Germany, and we're very glad the world is no longer divided in Germany. Second change, regarding the United States, and I think this is not understood enough by the Europeans. From my point of view, it is true that we only have one world power now, and the United States is militarily very strong. But this does not explain the political behavior of the United States, from my point of view. What it explains better is the new vulnerability. And what does this mean? The new vulnerability, mixed with extraordinary strengths, what regards the military means. But a real new vulnerability, and even more perceived vulnerability after 9/11. And never, America, in fact, you can't just say it has never been that strong, and the primacy has never been, it has never been as vulnerable as it is now. And if you don't analyze it that way, you don't understand what is going on. You may do the wrong things. I come to that later. But first you have to understand why some things are happening. During the Second World War, when Nazi Germany was at the height of its power and Imperial Japan was at the height of its power, they never had a chance to threaten Washington and New York. Nazi Germany was able to sink ships mid-Atlantic. There's a bizarre story about a German submarine that made it, I think, to the Mississippi Delta. There is the Japanese made it to the periphery, Honolulu, as bad as it was. They never made it. They were never a threat to Washington and New York. So you have to understand that this is completely new, the vulnerability. In the Cold War, there were thousands of Soviet missiles that could have gone to New York and Washington. But war was too dangerous, and that's why it didn't happen. Deterrence worked. Mutually assured destruction worked. Even sclerotic Soviet leaders understood about that, and so you were very safe. And now deterrence doesn't work anymore. And you have the fact that private organization can do more harm to the country than big countries could do, big states could do in the past. And what can you do about it? You cannot buy, even if you buy more aircraft carriers, doesn't help you one bit. So it is a very difficult new vulnerability. And when you look at what happened in 9/11, I must say I know states and the general staffs of states where I would say I don't believe they could have done it in the way Al-Qaeda did it to orchestrate the flights and bring them up in the same time. So I believe if you want to analyze the United States, yes, you have to understand it's the only superpower, world power. It is very strong, but at the same time, it is more vulnerable than ever before in its history. And I think out of this mixture, something was created that is causing a lot of trouble. And that is we don't agree when to go to war, and when not to go to war. And this is the one thing we have to overcome in the future. We cannot afford another instant where all the populations in Europe, be they in Poland, Great Britain, Aznar's Spain, or Berlusconi's Italy, in fact, they shared all the opinions of the French and the German government. The populations on the European side of the Atlantic were of one opinion. This was no reason to go to war. They were very much unified going to Afghanistan because there was a direct relationship with terrorism, but not with Iraq. One thing one has to say first is, it is much more difficult now, after the end of the Cold War, to decide when to go to war. It was very dangerous, but very easy in the Cold War. And just go to Berlin, and where my office used to be right now, that is 100 yards away, it's on the western side. If 10 or 12 Soviet soldiers, or even one, would have tried to get there, this would have been war. If at the checkpoint Charlie and I've been there when the tanks were confronting each other, the Soviet tanks had gone 10 yards on, there would have been war and no debate about it. And just because it was so clear, deterrence worked. It's much more difficult now, one must be fair to say, to decide when to go to war. But this is the worst danger that you can do to your populations when you disagree when you go to war. You can disagree about many fields, and it won't do that harm. And the American government has decided not to do a preemptive strike in Iraq. When you look at the French military strategy, they are very much in favor of a preemptive strike. They are the most outspoken in Europe, as long as there is an instant and very clearly defined imminent danger, you can, of course, do a preemptive strike. But this was a preventive war. Here I agree with Professor Walt, against possible dangers, you know this. And here I don't believe we can agree that you can have such kinds of wars. And the one thing we have to do in the future, take more time. Nobody expects anybody else to wait until he's hit, you know this. But we have to, more difficult but similar to the past, to find a way to agree when to go to war and when not. to go to war. The third thing that has changed is Europe and the European Union. And if this transatlantic relationship will work, the Americans have to understand that it is going to be a new Europe, and that a more equal partner than in the past. And they have also, some books are coming out on this subject to understand that power in the 21st century doesn't come in the first place. I say this also as former defense minister, out of tanks and planes and military means. The European Union, because the division of Europe was overcome, is today a very powerful organization. It has a transformative power in a way the United States lacks to some extent. I've been in the Ukraine before the Maidan, during the Maidan, and afterwards. Also in eastern Ukraine and Kharkiv, the young generation there, Russian-speaking, they also look to Brussels. It is the neighborhood of the European Union. It's a very dangerous neighbor, a highly infectious neighbor. And as long, and I come to the conclusions, as a country, as a perspective of membership, we have an enormous leverage. We are changing societies much more than anybody else, I believe, including Russia on the continent. And so if you want to have a fruitful relationship, in this transatlantic relationship, you have to understand that this is not just soft power or a power one need not realize that much, but it is very strong power, this transformative power, and that is something Europeans can bring in into this new relationship. Of course, to continue with Europe, we have this debate now, a divisive debate about the boundaries of Europe. And after the failure of the referenda in the Netherlands and in France, people feeling that the European Union is overstretched or is about to overstretch itself. I disagree very much because I believe if we want this new vital relationship, Europe has to be open for a wider Europe and has to export its stability. We have problems, yes, but it's not a crisis. And I always say, if you call this a crisis, what would you say if nobody wants to join the European Union anymore? And the first two countries would say, oh, we don't like this anymore, we'll leave the European Union. Nothing like that is happening. We have the opposite problem, that many, many countries say, we want to be part of the European Union, a full part of the European Union. And this transformative power we have to use vis-à-vis the Balkans, if we want to help them, the Ukraine, even Belarusia, there's some progress. And from my point of view, a Europe that would draw narrow boundaries or would draw a fence around the European Union and say, we keep out the problems, that would not be a partner for the United States in the 21st century. But a Europe that exports its stability changes Ukraine, changes Russia. And you can see this when you look at Kaliningrad, for instance. The young people there, they are looking to Lithuania and to Poland and to the European Union. Even in Petersburg, you can see that. You can see that with the Russian minorities in the Baltic states. The Russians are still complaining that they are not treated well enough. I always told the Balts, treat them better than your own people. And this will revolutionize Russia. Because I think you can already feel in Petersburg that people say, look, we have the same intelligence as our friends in Tallinn. Why don't we have the same kind of life? And so the European Union, I think, if it embarks on the right policies, will have more impact on Russia than the United States. Although you have this strategic relationship between the United States and Russia. And that is also the reason why I have welcomed negotiations with Turkey. That's an old promise. And nobody thought Turkey could live up to it. They don't fulfill the conditions for membership in the European Union, but to start negotiations about membership, which is a completely different thing. And the process counts. And if the European Union, which has already 15 million Muslims inside its borders, manages to bring together a Muslim, big Muslim country, and modern world and democracy, I don't think anybody will ask us, are we important in the 21st century? Then we are a really important partner of the United States in this century. And so I believe we will have a redefined and strengthened partnership once the European Union plays this role of stabilizing a wider Europe, including Turkey. And that would be the second point, United States and Europe together stabilizing the Middle East. Because I know there are dangers out there in Asia, North Korea, in the streets of Taiwan, used to maybe in the India-Pakistan relationship, but I believe the biggest dangers in the 21st century come out of the south of Europe, Middle East. What regards breeding grounds for terrorism, for terrorism, and the crises that could affect all of us from out there. So Europeanization of Turkey is one important contribution. Working together on the issue of Iran, and that can only be done between the Europeans and the Americans, and safeguarding a Palestinian state in the future that, although it sounds very visionary, will live as a good neighbor, I mean, together with Israel. This is something that I think that can only be brought about and created by Europeans and Americans together. So what we need is a genuine partnership in the alliance and an America that believes in one strong Europe, not trying to divide the Europeans, as they did, not just Rumsfeld did during the Iraq crisis. I will never forget, I was already out of office, but I was beginning of, just on the eve of the Iraq war, I was invited by the Turkish General Staff to their officers' school in Istanbul, 500 officers in uniform, and a representative of the Pentagon, and he said, Bulgaria is now a more reliable ally than Germany. I was really angry. And I got at that guy. And it's a very, very foolish thing to say, you know, this. But I have understanding, I mean, that countries of Eastern Europe, like Poland, the Baltic states, have a very close relationship with the United States. I'm comparing this with Germany in the 50s, for instance. I mean, when our security was very much endangered, our relationship to the United States was especially close. Closer than the relationship between France or others and the United States. So everybody comes into the European Union and into NATO with his own history. But these states also have to understand that they are part of Europe. And that sometimes, I mean, not just when it comes to Airbus or Ariane or Galileo, they have to look after European interests. And that they also have to work for a common point of view of the Europeans, because that is what the United States needs, and not a divided European Union of good and bad Europeans or old and new Europeans. I'm sometimes very outspoken. So when I saw this attitude in the Baltic states, in Tallinn, I think some 7 or 8 years ago, I said, you can work as hard as you like. You will never be an island off the coast of Virginia. You know this. You'll always be in Europe, if you like it or not. And so, and this is what I mean. I have every understanding for historic reasons, the close relationship with the United States. But that doesn't mean that they should not be part of the European process to bring about a common position. So what does true and genuine partnership mean? It means a joint analysis of the situation, joint decision-making, and joint action, and not using NATO, as was the case, as a toolbox where you use military capabilities. And the United States still has not really made up its mind if they want a united Europe, which can be a difficult partner. But I think in world politics of the 21st century, you need such a partner. And when you look at the globe, I don't think India is a substitute for Europe. China is a substitute for India. So Europe and the United States are still two regions of the world that have so much in common and can cooperate very well together in this 21st century in the spirit of partnership. I would like to talk about one military aspect, also as a former defense minister, because it is understood the economic strengths of Europe, the market strengths, the technology. But what about the military contribution of Europe? And here, I think you have to understand how different the organization is. We're spending almost two-thirds in Europe of what the United States spends in the military. But we only get about 20% or something for that, because we are organized as nation states. So that is 25 members, let's take the members of the European Union, that's 25 armies. You have only one army. We have something like 22 navies. Even the Hungarians have a river navy. I've seen them. And I don't know, we have, with the exception of the Baltic states, we have then probably something like 22 air forces. It's an illusion to believe that there will be a United States of Europe, one president, one government, one parliament. It will never happen. You know, it's completely different from the United States, the history of the states. That's a complete illusion, you know, to believe one man, I mean, could decide the fate of Europe. But like this, we cannot go on. You know, it's a waste of money. You know this, and so I've been working for a long time for more complementary structures in the military field. This doesn't mean that we tell a country, forget about your army. We'll do the job. But there are fields, especially in very expensive areas, where you could do that. When I was defense minister, as early as 1993, I said, why don't we merge the submarine fleets of Germany, Netherlands, and Norway? And you can imagine, in the light of the history, I mean, of the last century, what this would mean. These two countries have been invaded by Germany. But when you do this, you cannot say, but the headquarters, of course, has to be in Germany. Then this is finished forever. Still, nothing has happened in that field, but I think it's a possibility. Why shouldn't we have a fleet in the Baltic and in the North Sea and in the Atlantic? And down there in the south, the Italians have a conventional submarine fleet with somebody else, and the nuclear submarine fleets of the British and the French are special. Air Force, you know this. I told the new member, not Poland, it's a bigger country, but I told I didn't like it, the Hungarians and the Czechs, I said, don't buy planes, fighter planes, especially not from the Americans, but also don't buy them from the Europeans. Don't buy Eurofighters. It's a waste of money. I will look after your airspace. And by I said, why not have a German-Polish squadrons, you know this. And we look after the airspace of other countries. And they use the money, I don't know, for parachutists or for special contributions. It's not possible so far. It's a kind of, I don't know, a man has to appear in a certain way to be a man. You're only a state when you have fighter aircraft. This is what the Europeans so they're wasting their money by looking after their... it's a very small airspace. You can never defend it if you do it in a national way. It's a waste of money. It's a complete waste of money. With a transport aircraft, we are creating some European pool now. But to tell you the story, you really have to look at the big guys, and that's the British and the French. And this is really sheds light where Europe has to change, I mean, to be a more equal partner. And that's the aircraft carriers. This. No British plane can land on a French aircraft carrier. And sometimes the French planes cannot land on their own aircraft carriers. But that's a little nasty remark. You know, this. The French so far have had one aircraft carrier. And one thing I learned in office is if you have one boat, it's no boat. Only when you have two boats, it's one boat, you know, because boats sometimes have to be in repair, you know this. And but they are now thinking of new aircraft carriers, the British and the French. It is not clear yet if they're going to be complementary, you know this. It is clear that they are non-nuclear in their, well, they were powered, yeah. But it's not clear whether their architecture will be such that a British plane can land on a French aircraft carrier. I've been on the United States aircraft carriers, both out San Diego and Norfolk, you know this. And my impression is that American planes that in principle can land on aircraft carriers can land on the aircraft carriers, irrespective if they are from the West Coast or from the East Coast. Why is this so? And, of course, you would save a lot of money if you make these complementary. You know, so then the French aircraft carrier is in the dock. You can use the British aircraft carrier. If new technologies, new aircraft, you only get when you get new dependencies, you know this. And the real reason is, and you could see that in the Iraq, the British want to be free to send their aircraft carriers to a special place, even when the French don't want to send them there. If you have a complementary force in this field, you have to agree where to send your aircraft carrier. And they are not ready for this yet. I have made a suggestion on... I thought I was a great hero in France because they have all this complaining that we're not spending enough money. I said, I buy a squadron of Rafale fighter aircraft that can land on the aircraft carrier. And I stationed them on the French aircraft carrier. Oh, the... was very lukewarm, the reaction, because they understood very well, if I have a German squadron on the French aircraft carrier, I want to have a say where this aircraft carrier is going. And they don't like that. So this is the European nationalism that is still there. I don't tell to give up national armies. That would be completely unrealistic, you know, this. But complementary structures where it costs most money, not everybody doing everything. The Balts have no aircraft because one Eurofighter would take the whole budget, not just the whole military budget, the whole budget. They couldn't do anything else, you know this. And suddenly you can see you can do without your own fighter aircraft. What happens is that every 3 months there's a new squadron from a NATO country stationed in the Baltic states and looking after the skies. Recently, it was a German squadron, and when the Russians lost their way in the skies, for whatsoever reason, however, they got up and told them to leave. You know this, and it works. Can anybody tell me why this couldn't work for some medium-sized states, and they then take their money for something else? So I'm not just criticizing America for this lack of spirit and this. War of choice and this unilateral attitude that they have shown. But there's also a lot that has to happen on the European side what regards the military structures. When you look at the demography of the 21st century, this is even more reason to think about that. The demography of the United Nations says that right now Europeans have 12% of the world population. But when you look at it, this includes Turkey, Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia to the Urals. You know this. And this will go down, even with those countries, to 7% by 2050. It will be between 4 and 5%. Europe, if it's a small Europe, it will be like a Hong Kong in world politics. And I don't have to... Europe and America together, you know, will be a very small part of the world population. And so I believe this is all the more reason to work together. And I think I leave to our debate what we can do and should do together in the Middle East. What I would like to say in the end is, coming back to what I started, is don't take anything for granted. I have seen the Americans when I was a young boy in 1956 stopping the colonial powers, the British and the French, stopping the British and the French in Suez. I mean, it's completely different from the stories right now. I've seen them in stopping the Soviet tanks in Berlin. And I know from my own experience there would not have been any reunification of Germany without the American presence in Europe, because people would have been afraid of Germany. Too big, without a big guy still there. I think this has gone. And this, again, is the great advantage of the European Union that it has dealt with this problem of one country not just being very bad, but also very big, Germany. And when I was in Asia lately, I told the Japanese, you have to work for such a situation that your small neighbors, if you have any, tell you to spend more money in the military. But this is actually, I mean, who would have thought this is going to happen when you meet the Danes and the Dutch, who have all been invaded by Germany within hours, say you must spend more money in the military. And if the Japanese are in a situation, the Koreans come and say, please spend more money in the military, then they have some understanding, I mean, of the revolutionary process and how unique the European Union is, that it has overcome all of these old European problems. And I think America should understand, you know, it has an impact in Asia. ASEAN is closest to it. What the European Union has done, it's not the empire where you force others to be a member, but you're afraid that too many want to join. I mean, there's never been such an empire in the history where people say, let's be part of it, and people, oh no, we're too many coming into this. So for this generation, and I often cited Chancellor Kohl every second or third cabinet meeting, he was talking about the time when he didn't have enough to eat. Hard to imagine, but it was. And he's a Hoover Foundation and all this. And I still remember white chocolate from a British soldier, my first chocolate. But you can make many mistakes here. I still will be grateful. And it will not destroy my basic things. But what about the young generation now who have not seen us doing things together, who see us disagree about this fundamental question, when to go to war and when not to go to war? So the last story I want to tell is, in 2003, when the Iraq war had started, I was in Washington, talked to Tom Lantos. I like him, so I mentioned his name. I said, my daughter is 18. What can I do to explain this war to her? I cannot do it. And then he's, and she's no left wing and no nothing. And then he said, tell her to be grateful. I quote, tell her to be grateful. And this just doesn't work with the young generation in Germany. You can tell me, you don't have to tell me, you know, this. I know by myself. This young generation has to see us doing things together in the 21st century, has to see us agree when to use force and when not to use force. And if that happens, when they are 60, they will also remember, you know, this. And this is the danger that I see, this chasm on the two sides of the Atlantic, that this has not been happening in recent years, and we must come back to that. If they see us working together on stabilizing the European continent in the sense of the wider Europe, and working together and solving this most dangerous conflict in the Middle East, breeding ground also for terrorism, then they will have no problem to understand that we can redefine. We don't need a Soviet Union as an enemy. We don't need the Cold War. We don't need a divided world in Germany to be able to work together. It just takes new leadership and new understanding how to find out how important are we for each other in the 21st century. There are people out there who say Europe, Germany, no more important, India and China. They are not a substitute for Europe. They are very important for all of us, and we should also have a strategic dialogue on that, on the relationship with China. This cannot be done by NATO. EU, US has to do that. But so I'm optimistic in the end, if we do the right things and if we understand the new world of the 21st century, we can create a new transatlantic partnership, as important as it was in the Cold War, but completely different. And that is my message today. Thank you very much.
That was, as they say in show business, a tough act to follow. The minister has already, I think, laid out with clarity, with precision, and with authority, I should add, many of the sort of central issues which are facing the transatlantic relationship today, and I'm really not quite sure what of substance I can add to this presentation. I suppose the only thing that I can try to do is to try to place his comments from a sort of American academic perspective in a certain, no doubt, illusory grand strategic perspective. That is, after all, the duty of scholars such as myself. And as I'm sure many of your subordinates would have said once to you, ich melde mich zum Dienst, I'm reporting for duty on that score. So with that caveat out of the way, I also should add that your comment on the abiding power of nationalism reminded me of Friedrich Thorberg, the famous Austrian journalist's comment about nationalism as being the basically insane doctrine that every language has to have its own navy and its own postage stamp. I'm afraid Europe hasn't quite overcome that, but at least they can tolerate each other's navies and postage stamps, which is, I'm afraid, more than what we can say for East Asia, but that's another issue. In any case, what I'm going to try to do is just a very brief period of time which I have available to me, make three closely related points. First, regarding the nature of the current international situation, its structure, and I think you already did a wonderful sort of academic, in some ways, analysis of some of the important structural changes. But I would add a little bit more to that. Then I talk a little bit about the initial response on the part, especially of the United States, to that situation, and then to the particular problems that come out of both this situation and out of this response. First, I'll make the obvious point, is that we live in unusual times. Now, unusual times are not anything new, actually, in international relations, but we are, I think, still in the middle of a sort of transformative shift, and arguably it's the third important shift that we've seen over the last half century. And the shift that we've seen since 2001 and 9/11, I think, in some ways, is comparable in its importance and comparable also in the kind of confusion that it's creating to the shifts which occurred in 1945 and in 1989 to 1991. There has been a tectonic shift in the structure of international relations, and we are still very much trying to come to terms with that particular shift. The threat which we face today, of course, is different from the threats that we faced during the Cold War or in the initial, what we will probably call, we have not yet invented a good term for it yet, but the post-Cold War period between 1989, let us say, roughly, and 2001. But the problem of mass terrorism is different from the old terrorist problem. Of course, we know terrorism is an old problem. Germany knows it with the RAF and the Baader-Meinhof, IRA, the Corsican, Sardinian problems, ETA, and so forth. But the kind of terrorism that we face, in particular, the potential of terrorism using weapons of mass destruction is something which is new, and it's something which we are trying to come to terms with. And it certainly is altering American strategic behavior. In the initial days after 9/11, I remember one of the comments which one heard a lot is that nations tend to over-respond to terrorism in the short run and under-respond in the long run. I don't think we can say that any longer. There is now a fundamental shift, and we see it now in the institutional structures and the ways in which the United States is approaching to that. Now, this brings me quickly to the second point. The initial U.S. response to the advent of this threat of mass terrorism was not entirely wrong. I'm not going to be one of those academics who stands up and does the sort of ritualistic beating up of the neoconservatives, even though many of them do deserve a certain amount of beating, ritualistic or not. But there's certain points of that analysis were quite correct. But I think it is becoming increasingly clear that that response and the way it has been implemented is flawed. Deeply flawed. It's flawed both as policy and as politics. That is, it is flawed in terms of achieving the goals that it set itself, the spreading of democracy in the Middle East in particular. The idea that the United States, and I remember right after, a number of my friends have been working in the White House, and one of them working on East Asia for Dick Armitage reported on Armitage's sort of comment on how we're going to deal with these potential rogue nations which can supply terrorists with weapons of mass destruction. We can't take them all on. And Armitage said, no, but we'll take them onto the mat one by one, just like a high school wrestling champion. That particular image, that kind of machismo approach to this policy, to this particular problematic, clearly isn't working. And what we are seeing in North Korea, we're seeing in Iran are the limits of that policy. So it is not working as policy. It is also not working as politics. It obviously has not worked in terms of the transatlantic relationship, where after 2003 we found the European allies unanimously against us, even while some of the governments supported us. The public opinion polls showed that support was rather thin at best, even in Great Britain. And also, increasingly, we see that American public opinion, the willingness to fight, wage the war on terror in the terms that we've defined it in the 2002 strategic strategy of the United States, is evaporating or becoming much weaker. Now, again, I said this is nothing new, unusual times. There's a certain parallel I would draw to the early part of the Cold War. Those of you who look at the early part of the Cold War realize the United States had at least tried three different strategies for trying to come to terms with the Soviet threat. We had initial effort on the part of Roosevelt to engage the Soviet Union, the four policemen concept. We had rollback, where the United States under Truman administration tried to aggressively roll back, and under Dulles, in particular, tried to roll back communism wherever we could, before we finally settled on a containment strategy by the late 50s. It took us, in other words, almost 10 years to come to terms with the Soviet threat, and to coordinate that with our allies took even longer. These transitional periods take time, and there is confusion. And I would argue that we are still in a confusing time in which the different sides, both in the United States and Washington, and in Europe and other allied partners, I would mention Japan, I would mention South Korea, are trying to figure out how we're going to restructure the relationship to meet the particular new threats that we face. Now, that brings me to the third point. The particular kind of institutional structures which we have inherited from the Cold War and from the post-Cold War were developed to deal with a very different set of problems than the ones we faced. And the nature of the threat, of the challenge that we face, is fundamentally different. You talked about the Soviet Union, and I think you spoke very correctly about the sort of the disciplining effect that the presence of the glorious Red Army on Europe's border had upon alliance relationships. Of course, there were enormous disagreements. The history of NATO was one series of disagreements. I was speaking with a scholar who was collecting all the titles of books which were predicting the end of NATO. And he had gotten to 140 and was still counting. Yeah, so this is, you know, alliance catastrophes or problems are not new. But we always had this clear and present danger which had this disciplining effect. Now, in the post-1989, 1991, the post-Cold War period, the threat changed, and we moved from having the clear and present danger to having the much more unclear danger of just general instability, of the sort that we saw in, for example, the former Yugoslavia. And again, the Allies disagreed, but those disagreements could be allowed to run for a while, with catastrophic effects for the Bosnian-Herzegovinians and the Yugoslavs. I mean, 250,000 people probably died in the 1990s in the former Yugoslavia, but it was not a present threat, in the sense that vital or existential national interests were not endangered. Now, what makes this current situation unusual, and which I think we still need to think more systematically about, and I fault, by the way, my own profession for this, because I've been talking to a lot of people in recent years about this, in Steve Walt among them, about thinking about this issue, and we really haven't done a very good job of thinking about this the way, let us say, Bernard Brody or Thomas Schelling and others did about the Cold War. But the problem with the current threat is that we have a threat which, on the one hand, is not clear, but it is present. That is, there is the sense that we must respond to Al-Qaeda, of course, to the potential acquisition of nuclear weapons in North Korea and Iran. But at the same time, we disagree on how to respond and how real that threat is. And so the room for alliance volatility, that is, the room for disagreement, structurally speaking, is much greater than what we had before, and structurally much greater than the present set of institutions that we have, the way the decisions are made, for example, in NATO and so forth, allow us. Now, we've made some steps. We've adapted NATO successfully in Afghanistan. I thought you were going to talk a little bit about the contributions. But we still have not really come to an agreement about how we are going to make decisions in the context of these institutions. And I think we also may have to compartmentalize different areas. certainly nation building and these kinds of peacekeeping operations and stabilization efforts that we take place in Afghanistan and other places is an area where we need to build on cooperation to institutionalize it further. Non-proliferation treaty is a subject which we need to talk about desperately, because I think there is a basic understanding of the non-proliferation treaty system as such. While we may not want to jettison it, we probably do not want to jettison that, but it is in desperate need of repair, and I do not see enough serious and also public, it cannot just be private discussions here and there, but public discussion of the ways in which we may have to modify that regime in order to cope with the existence of countries like Iran, a nuclear Iran, a nuclear North Korea, and who knows what comes after. And the last point, which I think is the most disturbing one, and probably a number of people on the operational level in Washington are concerned about this, but it's something which we, again, have difficulty talking about, is what do we do in terms of deterrence? Deterrence worked during the Cold War, deterrence against the possibility of a Soviet or Chinese threat. Fortunately, the terrorists do not yet have, we believe, nuclear capabilities, but how do we deter the possible acquisition these capabilities from countries like Iran? But we are now beginning to face the situation. Jacques Chirac has also, among others, has begun to talk more openly about this. How do we now deter countries from transfer? And how do we then also create agreements between the allies? Because if we are in a situation where we're going to begin to try to deter systematically countries like Iran, countries like, well, possibly Pakistan and North Korea from transferring technologies of mass destruction to other countries, there will have to be certain agreements on what kinds of threats, what kinds of measures, and so forth will have to be taken to deal with that. And again, these are areas which I think we need to talk more about as allies. As any minister of defense will appreciate, we all have to operate with limited resources, and one of them is time. So I would like to join all of you in thanking very much the minister for a fantastic.
You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Department of International Relations at Boston University. Speaking was former German Defense Minister Volker Ruhe. Minister Ruhe's lecture was titled Transatlantic Relations in the 21st Century. Responding to the minister's lecture was Boston University Associate Professor of International Relations Thomas Berger. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.